Thank you very much, Steve, for the kind introduction and the patience in organizing it to several emails. I think we had a thread of about maybe 34 emails to get this to work. It's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor to be here. I'm excited to speak in front of people who approach things from the standpoint of math and from a modeling standpoint, I suppose. And this is something that I look forward to as a beginning of something interesting to continue. I have a pleasure and a privilege here to present you not as much with answers as more actually with the questions, which is kind of an advantageous position to give a talk. So I will start with what some people tend to end with, but I think it's essential, especially in the type of work we do. It's very much not ivory tower in the way that none of what you see would be conceivable without the help of all people that I list here. And it's a collaboration both at the University of Montreal, also at McGill now, and also at the Lawson Health Research, as well as with the microscopy departments there, and the funding that I have been able to receive. And so I'm thankful and acknowledging all that, and the help of the students immediately, actually a few weeks before the talk, who were able to go through some of the data that are completely new, and I was able to build into the talk for you to talk about. I would like to start with the end of the talk, in case you get either completely bored to have to go, or simply want to know why does he need all this time to tell me that. There are many ways to approach what I would like to speak about. One of them is an epistemological view of the problem, and that is really spoken in a wonderful way by Abdus Salam, the particle physics Nobel Prize winner from 1979, who said that the nature is not economical of the structures, but it is economical of the principles. Why do I think it's a fitting way to introduce? Because what I'm attempting to convey is the notion that the plethora of the patterns that we see in the signals from the fetus that we want to analyze to capture signals of incipient asphyxia, hypoxia, or infection may in fact be probably captured by some of the properties of the signals that can lie in the domain of complexity, entropy, or the time domain, the frequency domain, in the modalities such as the brain electrical activity or the heart activity. But really underlying that, I think that are indeed some of the algorithms that may not be as complex in a way of a model as the patterns that we see. So in some way, I think this is a good way of seeing it. And why should we care as the clinicians about it? Is we do have a problem in obstetrics that really the field of the monitoring of fetal health hasn't really changed since the early 80s. And we have the babies that are born in increasingly because of the burden of the prematurity with the cerebral palsy and infections. And the only way to look at the babies before they are born is indeed non-invasively by acquiring the fetal heart rate. And that is usually done by the... apologize, I should have switched it off. This is not... You get so used to it that it becomes a part of your brain, and then you can't kind of switch it off. It shouldn't happen. Okay. It can be. This is really spooky because I turned off the reception. Okay, it will stop. I apologize for that. So you have the problem that you need to monitor the babies. The only way to do it is by looking at the fetal heart rate. I trust it was a prequel of the St. Patrick's. And so there are two ways to do it in the labor. One is again to look at the fetal heart rate, which we can acquire from the fetus from the head of the fetus once it is ahead enough that we can attach an electrode. And another way to do it is again from this electrode by looking at the brain electrical activity, the EEG electroencephalogram. And what we can acquire from that are twofold things. Some can tell us something about the hypoxia and asphyxia of the animal, that is the lack of oxygen or increase of the PCO2, which both are associated with the increased basic risk of cerebral palsy, the stroke of a baby. And they also can teach us something about the inflammatory status of the fetus. And that, again, is a corollary that can also lead to the cerebral palsy, but can also imprint the brain for later altered responses to renewed exposure to infection. So essentially, you have these two things, the fetal heart rate that you can acquire from ECG, from the activity of the fetal heart, and the EEG, and they're able to inform us about the hypoxia, asphyxia, and the infection. So one of the emerging ways to extract information from the fetal heart rate has been, since the 80s, the fetal heart rate variability, or the heart rate variability as a concept, was introduced in the 80s by Oxenbrot in a science paper. That is probably the article you want to look at if you look at the history of the heart rate variability. And ever since, a lot of work has been done in adults, in cardiology, and in the neonates, but not so much in the fetuses. And I will speak about it more now. It seems to be a promising tool to detect hypoxia and asphyxia in a way that the monitoring use now at the bedside is not able to do. So what I'm eventually looking for, and I would like you to take from this from a bedside standpoint, is that we're looking for ways to process the patterns that we see in the modalities of the heart rate and electroencephalogram in a multivariate way. So not just looking at the properties of this and the properties of that and the properties of that, but attempting to get a kind of a landscape view of this, if you want to think of an attractive landscape. And then, of course, to see how that can be applied with the devices that we actually have that are by far not as ideal as those in the world of the adult ECG, where the sampling rate is an issue, the noise, the signal is an issue, all these things are an issue. So this is the bedside view, and now one view that I should not even attempt to talk about, but of course I cannot but attempt to do it because I'm here, is the sort of the summary from a mathematical standpoint. In the past, we tended to look for answers to the problems in the physiology or biochemistry, if you want, from a magic bullet standpoint. We thought we're going to get a marker and it's going to do everything. And in fact, there are some that seem to do well for some of the diseases, but overall, it doesn't approach even approximately the complexity of what we deal with in physiology or in the real life in the medicine. Still in the past, then, was the thinking, okay, well, a magic bullet doesn't really do it. What if we apply a lot of them? And then we're going to see the patterns, but we don't really know how to deal with the patterns. So as long as we just have the bullets that are detecting a condition A, condition B, condition C, but we don't know how this interacts in space and time, we really don't really know yet what to do with it. So disconnectedness was an issue. And there is an irony here that occurred to me when I was thinking about it, that even the measures that were derived from the chaos theory, that were basically inspired by the notions of interactivity, the connectedness, the self-organization, they were in fact deployed in a non-actually chaos theory way as the single descriptors of the physiological states. So what I'm looking forward to, and I would like you to see this from a mathematical standpoint, is a vision of attractors that would integrate in a multivariate way the modalities that we're able to acquire to monitor the fetal health and to describe them in a dynamic way, in a temporal way, in such a way as to kind of have an eagle's view of the system, whether it is an animal model or it is a human study or a patient, to have a model that would encapsulate the modalities we have, different ways to describe the properties that we have in the domains of heart rate variability, EEG to be specific, and to try to abstract from the many bullets that I was just speaking of. So this is essentially the end of the talk, and now I will go back to the beginning and attempt to give you a bit more meat on the skeleton that I was attempting to construct. So the physiology and the monitoring of the heart rate variability in EEG is the content of that slide. First, before the baby is actually born, what we know in a crude kind of way is that the autonomic activity, so the activity that is controlling things that we're not aware of, such as the heartbeat and respiration, matures in fact around the 32nd week, and we're able to monitor it in animal model or in the humans by some of the changes of the properties of the Hatch iterability. One of them is the RMSSD, which is a Riemann square of successive differences of R intervals of ECG. I will explain in a moment what that is from a mathematical standpoint a bit more exactly. So basically, statistics of the ECG, if you like, can inform us about the short-term alterations or the variability of the theta heart rate, and that informs us about the activity essentially of the brain. And that is a neat way to do it because it's non-invasive if you know how to do it. It's not a routine on the bedside, but it can be done non-invasively with the ultrasound. However, here the issue is the sampling rate. I will speak about it a bit more. But it's important to keep in mind that the majority of the hospitals across the continent are using the fetal heart rate. So it doesn't really help us to say, well, we need to increase the sampling rate. That's what we deal with. That's the reality. So we need to try to get choose from the plethora of the properties of the Hatch iterability, those that are able to describe the physiology still with a precision basically high enough despite the issues of the sampling rate. We do have ways to derive the data with a precision that would be adequate using the fetal magnetocardiogram, but this is essentially only available in a few centers on the planet, one of them back in Germany where it was at the University of Jena, one at the in the States, in the university, in the Little Rock University, and one I think is also in Japan. That's about it. So doesn't exactly help to serve the population on a large scale, but is an amazing tool to learn and to confirm the findings that we do in animal model. Then if it comes to monitoring of the brain electrical activity before the birth, really the only thing we have is the magnetoencephalogram. So non-invasive way to tap into the brain waves of the fetus. Again, essentially only in the centers that I just spoke of are you able to do that. And again, an amazing tool to get onto the physiology of the human brain before the birth, but of course not something to plan with to spread and across the hospitals. The sensitivity of the magnets and the squids there is so high that they can sense a tram a few kilometers away within a shielded area, a Faraday cage. So definitely not only something for the specialized centers. But what we do know from the models in animals and studies in the humans that the brain electrical activity also matures well before the birth, and the maturation of the brain is expressed in development of the behavioral states that is the REM and the non-REM states of the active sleep and the quiet sleep and the neonates. And that is also sensitive to hypoxia and asphyxia. And there is also, and it's important when we speak about a multivariate approach to analysis of the data from the fetus, that there is a correlation in the changes in the brain electrical activity and the autonomic activity, so in the heart rate variability. They're not independent, absolutely far from it. In the time of the birth, we have a lot more options because the fetal head at some point is exposed enough that we can actually attach an electrode, so we're able to acquire ECG, and we can also acquire the fetal EEG. I will speak about it a bit more and what we might be able to extract from it and how that might be useful for detection of hypoxia asphyxia. So from a clinical standpoint, the issues that are important is that as you see here, the hypoxia and asphyxia before the birth is essentially a process we don't really know a lot about because we don't really have a way to see it except by inference at the time of the birth and the condition of the fetus. So what we do know, however, from the animal models is that the inflammatory events and the hypoxic events in the majority, over 70%, do occur, in fact, well before the time of the labor. And they do impact the development of the baby, and they do impact the ability of the baby to deal with the stress it experiences in the time of the birth and afterwards. In the time of the birth, the contractions of the uterus, of course, are influencing the blood flow to the baby, to the brain especially, and so they obviously do lead to decrease of the fetal oxygenation. Amazingly enough, the brains of a fetus and a newborn are able to deal with the hypoxia a whole lot actually better than we do as the adults, which makes a lot of sense, otherwise we wouldn't be here right now. And however, some of the babies don't seem to do as well as the others, and we don't really know why. And it's apparently a mixture of inflammatory events before the birth and hypoxic events before the birth, which we don't really know which of the babies had, that seem to contribute then to some of the babies being more susceptible to the hypoxia and the stress in the labor than the others. So the cerebral palsy as an extreme event of a stroke, of a neonatal stroke, is an outcome. But also after birth, the neurodevelopmental sequelae of such events can be basically for the life. And I don't just speak about the stroke and maybe adults that you sometimes see that may in fact be the carriers of such experience from the birth. I also speak about the subtle things and the dysfunction on a cognitive level that can only be often seen in the school. And that's something that we look at more and more. And also the notion that the neuroinflammation, the inflammation in the brain can in fact impact on the development of the brain for the lifetime. So it is not only that we're looking at a particular age in the life of a human, we're looking at a time when the foundation seems to be made for a lot of events and the susceptibilities to events in a future life. So this is the clinical angle on the problem. And so we're looking for ways to capture the asphyxia and the hypoxic events before the birth and in the time of the birth. And there is a concept of neuroinflammatory, of a pathway that is called the cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway. And I will speak about it a bit more. It's an intriguing insight into the physiology of the primates, if you like. In fact, it's been also shown that a kind of a cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway seems to exist even in the organisms that are far not as complex as we are. And that is essentially a way of the brain to control the innate immune system responses to inflammatory to the inflammation. And why that is interesting for the monitoring of inflammation and extraction of signals and properties of the signals, I will speak about now. At the end of the day, we want to identify the markers of the properties of the heart rate variability, such as the ones shown here. Some of them I will speak a bit more essentially in the time domain and the complexity domain. That would work probably best to identify the changes in the activity of the brain in response to hypoxia, asphyxia, and infection. So in the next slides, I will speak about the heart rate variability, the modality one. So it's the modality that we get out of ECG of the heart, of the activity of the heart, essentially. And I will speak about the fetal EEG, the brain electrical activity, and then I will attempt to ask a question. So I spoke before about the RMSSD. So what is that? This is a symbolic sequence of ECG, just like you see in the emergency room or the Gray's Anatomy, whatever is on right now. And so you see this R peaks of the ECG, and symbolically these are basically the intervals between them. And these are the fluctuations of differences between the intervals over time. So this is kind of a derivative of the properties of the heart rate. So while the differences between the heart rate are at the level of the seconds, so it's the 52 beats and 84 beats. That's what you all get when you look at your pulse. But something that most of us probably will not be able to capture without a computer are the fluctuations on the millisecond, actually, time scale between our intervals. And this is where apparently the information about the modulation of heart activity by the brain seems to be contained. So one of the measures in the domain of time that we can use to describe that is called the RMSSD, the Rittman square of successive differences of the R intervals. So that's really all that is. And we know from the physiology view that the brain exerts a control over the brainstem, where the centers sit that control the respiration and the heart activity. And so the heart unto itself is well able to beat on its own, but it's the modulation of the autochtonic, the innate ability of the heart to beat, that then embeds the information about the brain influences on the heart rate. That is the heart rate variability. So the increases in the sympathetic activity, that's the flight and fight response, they are going to limit the heart rate variability, to decrease it. The increases in the vagal, in the parasympathetic input from the brain are going to increase it. And so the parasympathetic activity you can think of in a simple way as the activity you get after you just had a cup of coffee and a cake. This is your state of mind. This is where you want to be probably most of the time. But I guess if you go through a subway, at some point you might want to get the sympathetic activity increased to get the door of the subway. And that's, I guess, about the stress we should have in our days. But this is the concept how to translate the statistics of the heart rate variability into the physiology. In response to infection, we know that we have both activation of the sympathetic and the parasympathetic sides of the autonomic nervous system, and they're expressing changes in heart rate variability, and at the same time, alteration of the players of innate immune system that then have to deal with the exogenous or endogenous basically stimulation that activated them in the first place. It can be bacteria or it can be acidemia or asphyxia or hypoxia as a stimulus from inside, as an aseptic stimulus, if you like. So how do we acquire the heart rate variability from the beginning? So we need to record the ECG, we need to digitize it and to detect the artifacts, to reject the artifacts, and then we get a sequence of the R intervals, and then we are able to process the sequence and different from different aspects in the time domain and in the frequency domain, but also from looking at the properties in the nonlinear from a nonlinear domain, such as the fractal dimension, entropy, complexity, and the others that are shown here. Most interestingly, also I find that a little bit understudied now is the comparison with the surrogate data. I will show you a slide or two about why I think that could be of interest. In the system that we use specifically, that is called the SIMVA, the continuous individualized multivariate analysis of the heart rate variability. You know about the system probably if you attended a talk by Andrew Seely from University of Ottawa a few years ago, who spoke here as well, and so he's a collaborator of mine. He's a surgeon with interest in complexity and sepsis from the standpoint of ICU. He's interested in patients and the intensive care unit who seem to develop the sepsis, but we don't know when and how far along the development of the sepsis they are, so he wants to see the properties and heart rate variability that would inform us as early to be able to capture them and to give them antibiotics not too late. In a way, in a fetus, we kind of have a similar issue, as I just attempted to give you an idea of. And so the system essentially does a similar thing that I just spoke of in an abstract way. And the SIMVA core specifically is able to give us 80 different aspects of the heart rate variability in time domain, frequency domain, and complexity domain in the mixes of those. And so that is then basically done in a continuous way over hours of the recording, and we're able to match it to changes in the metabolic, basically, information of the fetus, in inflammatory response of the fetus over time. So we indeed do get kind of a landscape of correlation of measures of heart rate variability to the metabolism of the fetus and to the inflammatory response of the fetus. A lot of data with which we don't quite exactly know yet how to do unless we want to continue analyze them until I basically get to retire, which is not my intent. And this gives you an idea about specifically how the data is output and sort of the first impression that we get. So we're able to select within the 80 heart rate variability measures. And so this is the RMSSD that I just spoke of that is average over hours. And you simply are able to see the fluctuations of the RMSSD, the properties of heart rate variability on a short-term time scale over the hours. And this is how it's done, the detection of the R peaks over time to derive from this the RMSSD sequence. You're welcome to interrupt. Yeah, I was alluding, this is a good point, I was alluding before that the changes in heart rate variability are associated with changes in the behavioral actually states. So the behavioral state and physiology is that idea that we go with our body essentially through the REM state, the active sleep, through the non-REM sleep, and when we seem to be completely awake, like hopefully I am now. And so this is kind of a rough way of where we are in your life. And about a third of the time we are actually asleep, a daunting idea. And so the fluctuations that you see here have to do with the changes in the brain activity that is either in the deep sleep or in the REM sleep, with some of the periods of the artifacts from the motion of the animal, which will impact on the quality of the signal and some of the things that we see. But they also are influenced by things like the sampling rate of the signal that I alluded to before as well, which is an issue. And they're also influenced by things like the interventions, of course, that we do. So if we administer a stimulus to the animal, be it an inflammatory one, or if we induce hypoxia in the model, we also are going to see a change here. So it's either endogenous fluctuations in the behavioral state activity or exogenously induced alterations in the activity. That is really the idea of how we should be able to get information from the system. So just to give you a brief sort of walk through what is kind of a baby of ours from the past few years, it's the notion of autonomic information flow as one of the ways to look at the complexity properties of the heart iterability. And the neatness of that, in of course a biased way of speaking of it, is that it not only allows you to assess complexity at a time scale determined a priori independently of the physiology that's underlying the system, but actually what we are saying is we will not say what the time scale should be. We are going to look at all the time scale on which we're able to say anything about the complexity of the signal, and then we are going to extract the change over the time from a single basically heartbeat to as many heartbeats as we know any physiologically interesting information should be in. So the beauty of that is that it allows us to correlate that to time scales of physiological activity that are linked to the activity of the parasympathetic and the sympathetic activity of the brain. So not stay entirely abstract at the level of, well, that is a complexity. Well, how is this actually linked to the physiology? So here we kind of are able to make a bridge, and we're able also to add a dimension here by looking at the surrogate data, so where we take out all the nonlinear aspects of the heart iterability, and then can ask, well, what's the contribution of the non-linearity to the properties of complexity over the time scale and the linear properties only? And it seems that, for example, we would be able to pick out the influences of the sympathetic activation from some of the properties that are addressed in that way. So this is just an example of how the complexity may be, how the complexity of the heart iterability may be used to address a physiological issue. So what do we do specifically in the animal model? I use a non-anesthetized instrumented fetal sheep, a model that's been in use in physiology and development of the fetal brain for the last 40 years. And what we are able to do is, in a surgery, in aseptic surgery, we're able to take the fetus out of the sheep, and we can instrument the fetus with the catheters and the electrodes to, for example, to be able to sample the blood for the metabolic changes and to inject whatever we need to inject to induce an inflammatory response. We can also obviously get the ECG or the brain electrical activity. Then we put the fetus back into the uterus. We complete the surgery, and we allow the animal to basically recover, and then we're able to conduct an experiment for as long as a month and look at the spontaneous activity of the behavioral states and the responses of the physiology of the fetus to the stimuli that we expose it to sample blood and so on. And then in the necropsy after the experiment, we can also look at the brain and look at the inflammatory response in the brain. So this just to give you a brief idea. And so you see, we do the surgery. It's essentially not so different from a human one. And the postoperative recovery afterwards, and a very happy animal on average, pretty much all the time. They really seem to be extremely happy with I think they have a better life with us than they would have on the farm. And then the experiments, and this is just to give you a more exact idea of how that actually looks. The design of the experiments that we used to study the physiology that I spoke of is that in about the 32nd week equivalent of the gestation for the human, we do the instrumentation as I just spoke of, and then we can instrument, abstractly speaking, in this way. So just to remind you, so we can do the brain electrical activity in the sheep. We are able to implant the electrodes immediately on the dura, not on the head, as we of course would do in our kind. So we call it an ECOG for the not electroencephalogram but the corticogram. So it's called ECOG. We can do the ECG recordings, arterial blood sampling and injection into the vein. We can sample blood. We can also sample from the amniotic cavity where the infection can also express itself, and we can induce asphyxia through the occlusion of umbilical cord as it may occur in the human labor. So that's the model, and what I've done in the past several years was to describe the spontaneous and the challenge activity of the cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway as this basically as a network that seems to link the brain and the innate immune activity in responses to inflammation. And in the experiments a few weeks after that, about the week 35 of the human gestation, so to give you the perspective, so we usually are born, we are considered okay to be born after the week about 38. So this is just about before the time when we should be born. And so we induced asphyxia in the animals, or we induced inflammatory states through administration of a lipopolysaccharide, which is an agent that is found on the surface of some of the bacteria, and a common way to induce inflammatory response in an animal model. In fact, in some of the instances, actually, in the volunteers, in the humans as well. So what I will show you in the following few, in some of the slides now, is the summary of the results that we got by looking at the interactions between the brain and the innate immune response to the stimuli, and the findings in the asphyxia basically model of the fetus, and the changes of the heart rate variability and EEG in this model as a source to get at the patterns in the heart rate variability and EEG. Here is just a summary of the experiments where we induced the inflammatory response, and all you need to see here is that we have a surgery, then we wait for the animal to recover, and then we're able to continuously acquire the ECG to get the fetal heart rate variability from it, and to give the stimulus such as the LPS to induce inflammation, and essentially at the necropsy look at the brain of the animal. What we found looking at the relation between the inflammatory status of an animal of a fetal sheep and the heart rate variability, the RMSSD, was a confirmation of the findings known now for the adults, for basically ourselves. If I were to sample all of the blood from you and put a Holter ECG and get the heart rate variability, you probably would see a correlation like this. The idea being here that the RMSSD on the x-axis, the heart rate variability, so the higher it is, in a way you can think, the higher is the parasympathetic outflow from the brain. So the fetuses who have more activation of the parasympathetic outflow from the brain have a stronger suppression of inflammatory activity in the body. That's a good thing. Could speak about that specifically for an hour, but it's not what we want to get at here. It just kind of is only meant to give you the idea that a mathematical aspect of the heart rate variability seems to be able to inform you about the inflammatory state of the body. That unto itself I find an interesting thing. And so the concept here in the model is that the brain at any basically time is able to sense the inflammation status in the body and seems to be able to translate that into changes, adjustments of the homeostasis to increase the heart rate variability by increase of the vagal outflow, and that we see in increases of the RMSSD, and at the same time it suppresses the the production of inflammatory cytokines. These are the molecules that we have in the body to induce inflammatory response when we have an infection, for example. And so that will then lead to decreases in inflammatory cytokines and explain the negative association, the correlation between the RMSSD and, for example, IL-1 beta, one of the major inflammatory cytokines that we have in the household. When we want to challenge the inflammatory response in a fetus, we can do that either with asphyxia or inducing an infection. Here, examples of challenging the inflammatory response through asphyxia, very similar to the stroke in adults. We know that a stroke induces not only changes in the brain itself, but actually influences also the inner community. And one of the effects that it has is an activation of inflammatory response in one of the stages. In the fetus, it is seen both through the increase of the RMSSDs, activation of the parasympathetic outflow, and at the same time, we see increases in the IL-1 beta, again, the pro-inflammatory cytokine. So of course, not surprisingly, we see a positive correlation between the two. And most interestingly, and that is really the novel thing in a general insight into the connection between the brain inflammation and the mathematical aspects of the heart heritability, that the fetuses that are able to mount a stronger activation of the parasympathetic activities in the response to asphyxia seem to have lower cell counts of the microglia, which are the innate immunity cells in the brain, similar to the macrophages in the body, that basically are there to react to the inflammatory stimuli or to asphyxia. So less of them after an insult is a good thing, means that there is less exaggerated inflammatory response to asphyxia. Exaggerated inflammatory response means more alterations in the connectivity of in the brain, and in general, is not seen as a good thing. So in a nutshell, more activity of the vagus nerve seems to correlate to suppression of inflammatory response in the brain. And what's interesting, we were able to corroborate the findings that I just showed you in experiments done about four probably years after. And what we did here was we administered LPS to induce the inflammation, and essentially we see exactly the same thing, again, in the fetal brain, the same age in the developmental stage. Here we looked not only at the RMSSD, and again, the microglia cell counts here at the y-axis, but we also looked at other aspects. For example, the symmetry of the distribution of the R intervals, so it's the measure called the skewness. And we also looked at the sample entropy. Why specifically that? Because the sample entropy, as a measure of complexity of heart heritability, has been shown to work well in the neonates to detect onset of the sepsis. So we said we cannot really, we don't have a heuristic way to pick out any of the AT measures, so we wanted to have a physiological way to pick out those of which we expect to do the best in detection of inflammatory response. So we picked the RMSSD, the skewness, and the sample entropy. In a nutshell, the findings are very similar to what you just saw, more activation of the parasympathetic activity due to the administration of the stimulus will lead to decrease of the microglia cell counts. This is kind of a raw data, if you want, from seven animals to which we either did not give any LPS. This would be with the red arrow in the case where we see a false positive, or we gave LPS in the dose of 100 or 200 basically nanogram. And so as you see, again, you see here the responses over time. Day one, the first, the baseline, first hour, third hour, sixth hour, the 12th hour, then 24th hour, then on the day two and on the day three. And we know that the inflammatory response, if you look at the cytokines, occurs in about 3 to 6 hours or so. And so if you look at the behavior of the measures of the heart heritability, RMSSD doesn't actually do so well, and the false positive here are a little bit too many for my taste. The skewness, the measure of symmetry of heart heritability, does maybe a tiny bit better, but overlooks one animal. The sample entropy, however, does excellently in terms of detecting animals that got LPS, but overlooks one. But if you look at the combination of the two, in that small set of the seven animals, we should be able to pick out all animals that got inflammatory response. So this is a modest beginning of trying to say a combination of the measures of the heart heterobiology might actually help us to get at a set of the measures that would allow us to say this is a fetus that seems to develop an inflammatory response. This is an information we do not have at the moment in the clinical routine. So that's from the fetal sheep. And so to summarize the model of the challenged activity of the brain and the response of the brain to the inflammatory risk, the stimulus, this is again going back to the diagram here, and what we conceptualize here, that the afferent endings of the vagus nerve, if you want, the sensors that are all over basically our body, especially in the abdomen and in the thorax, they sense the inflammation, whether induced through exogenous or endogenous stimulation. So as I said, exogenous can be bacterial, endogenous can be acidemia, asphyxia, or ischemia, as you know. And so that leads to increases in inflammatory cytokines, a primary kind of a response of the innate immune system to inflammation. And then that is sensed in the brain. And some people even speak about, you know, the concept of the homunculus, where you have the areas of the brain that can control a thumb, an arm, a leg, and so on. The same ideas are made now also in a holographic kind of way, that the homunculus that allows us to control the movements of the body and the speech and so on seems to also exist in the neocortex for the innate immune system. It's all kind of overlaid in an anatomical way. So just to give you kind of a food for thought about it, I think a kind of a beautiful idea to think about. So in the brain, wherever that is, we don't really know exactly all the areas. It's only basically in the phase of exploration, a response is being formed such that at the end of the day, you see increase of the vagal activity for the nerves that are going to the heart, which is an epiphenomenon that allows us to get the information about it from the heart rate. And importantly, then we also see a suppression of the inflammatory response in the brain that then leads to decreased activation of the microglia, again, those cells of the innate immune response in the brain. And so that is able to modulate the brain inflammatory response. If you want to know, we know a fair bit about the molecular biology of why the vagus nerve is actually able to do that, or why the cholinergic activity, so the cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway is able to induce a change like that and decrease the inflammation. In a brief way of speaking, the vagus nerve can interact with a subtype of nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. This is the receptor you also have on the muscles, as a matter of fact, and that's how we used to know it about a decade ago. The knowledge that the receptors like this one exist all over the brain and are, in fact, important to understand and to help, for example, the patients with Alzheimer's as well. That is a new thing that is only about a decade old. But it seems that not only are they important in the treatment of Alzheimer's, but they also are important in modulation of inflammatory response overall. And so the stimulation of the receptor will lead to decrease of the expression of the inflammatory cytokines. In other words, will have the anti-inflammatory effect. So all I want to say with that, there is a very a fairly deep understanding of the pathway, and it seems to be like this across the species. This gives you then an example of an attempt to simulate the process of the labor and what would happen in the asphyxia that we see in the labor in a model in the fetal sheep. And again, the figure that you just saw, the x-axis is simply the time, and the boxes that you see are signifying a baseline and then increasing acidemia in the fetus induced through the occlusions of the umbilical cord. And so here's the RMSST, simply averaged over time, and you see a slow but a continuous increase of RMSST with increasing with the severity of occlusions and acidemia increasing over time. What you have to know about the recording here is that the sampling rate is here the ideal one with a 1,000 hertz. This is what we know should be the sampling rate to capture the variability well in that animal model and also in the humans. What we did here is a simple thing. We simply ask, well, if we do the sampling rate more like the obstetricians have to deal with, just on the 4 hertz, what would we get? Would we still be able to see the change in heart rate variability with RMSSD in the same way? Well, it's kind of a disappointing half, in a way, outcome. You see here again at the baseline, the red line here shows an overestimation of the heart rate variability due to undersampling of the heart rate variability, a common thing in the biosignal analysis. We should have known that, and we did, but it was interesting to test it in an exact animal model that is known to describe the process of asphyxia in the liver well. So we see here an overestimation. We still do see an increase of the RMSSD with increasing asphyxia, but because of the error at the baseline, if we were to attempt to use it as a tool, we would, and we saw that here in the 7 basically animals where we did the experiment, we would not be able to capture the increase of the heart rate variability in 2 of them. So the bottom line is that if you look at the in a statistical way in the 7 animals, if you sample with 1,000 hertz, you get the detection in all of the fetuses about an hour ahead of the onset of severe acidemia, which is really cool, because this is something we are not able to do now in the clinical routine. And if you sample it with the 4 hertz, which is the precision of heart rate variability we would be able to get from the ultrasound, then we can only do it as about maybe half an hour after we would be able to detect it with 1,000 hertz. Basically sampling rate, and we would lose a few fetuses because of that. And this is the data from just about a week ago, the summary. We were looking at the clinical study that I'm doing in the obstetrics at the delivery ward, where we simply ask the women in the labor to record the heart rate, and we also sample the cord blood to look at the inflammatory response. The data for that we don't have yet because we need to wait on agglomerate a set to actually do the assays, but we can look at the heart rate variability over time. This is again RMSSD, just like you saw on the slide just before for the fetal sheep, but this is from a human fetus at a comparable age, and you see an increase of the RMSSD over time. And so this is, if you look at the time axis, just before the baby was actually born. So it matches really well. Don't look at the numbers. The absolute numbers are not the same, but the idea is the same. You see a trend in the increase of RMSSD of the heart rate variability. And essentially, I could actually go to the obstetrician and say, if I look at it, if I were able to analyze it actually online, I would be able to tell when the baby actually would be born. Something that obstetrician doesn't really know. Well, they kind of know once they've done it for 40 years, but there is no objective way. So here you see a direct example of how the properties of the heart rate variability can really inform you about the physiology with the precision that you can kind of see a point on which there's a correlation with the time of birth.
How do you tell them it's going to be born?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. This is a key question. Here, of course, I know it after the fact because I know the time of the birth, and we looked at the subset of the babies where we happened to be able to record the heart rate just before the birth, and in 5 others we also got the fetal heart rate, but the labor continued on for more hours, for 4 hours or so, and there we did not see the increase. So what I'm saying is, In the babies that are basically born within an hour of the increase, we do observe it in a kind of after the fact way. In the babies that are not yet about to be born within an hour, we do not see that increase.
Oh,
there is this is a fascinating issue to think about. There is a work by the German scientist at the lab that was looking at the synchronization of the heart rate variability and the heartbeats between the mother and the fetus. In fact, it does exist, and it's considered to be more of not a connection in an anatomical way, but more like an entrainment phenomenon. So, but nevertheless, it is there. And as a matter of fact, the fascinating thing is, this lab looked at the properties of the heartbeat. I think they use the symbolic dynamics approach in a sort of way. And so if you analyze the African you know, the music of from the African beats for the complexity. And if you analyze the heartbeats of the fetus, it seems to be a similar thing. So there's a certain idea that here the heartbeat, which we're exposed to for a long period of time, seems to actually inform in some actually way the properties of the heartbeat of the baby, so the maternal heartbeat. So to what extent the entrainment actually from the mother onto the fetus impacts on the structure of the heartbeat variability is only kind of a new thing. You can look in the PNAS, the Proceeding of National Academy of Sciences, for the paper by it's the Betterman, like the better person, Betterman. That's one of the papers that was there on the topic. And so that's essentially the summary that they kind of give from what I can tell. And the question is, would we be able to take advantage from looking actually at the maternal heart variability to feedback to say anything about the fetal? Well, that's the really interesting thing. And that's, I think, where interaction would be really needed, because this is a very intricate approach where you need both, you know, the mathematics and the physics, and you need the feedback to what we can get from the clinical setting. And in fact, the model that we have would allow easily to do that in the animals. The fetal sheep model, I didn't say the sizes of the fetus and of the mother are extremely similar to those of the humans, as much as the sheep, of course, has a similarity to the human. I'm not saying it does, but it's as far as you simply look at the weight, at the development of the brain, at the timing, at the physiology, it is a very good model. So we, in fact, would be able to address that type of things. And I would be very open and excited to see what might be done and to design a smart experiment to not just to acquire the data. That's not a trick. How to analyze them in a new way. So, if you're interested, do look at the work in the PNAS, and we can see what might be done. To summarize the findings and the ideas that I was speaking of, from the clinical fetal heart rate variability analysis that you just saw, we feel that the pilot study that we are doing now certainly has a basis that we hope to build into a multi-center study also with obstetrics here, Alan Bucking, hopefully at the University of Western Ontario and the McGill, so to be able to recruit the patients at the larger numbers. And basically to test the ability of the heart rate variability algorithms to describe the responses to fetal asphyxia and the inflammation. The feasibility is not an issue anymore, and the beauty of what I'm so excited to be able to do at the University of Montreal is that we have a device that is approved to be used in the humans and is the only one where you can actually get the raw, basically, fetal heart rate data. All the others are basically a black box, and you're not able to get at them except after the fact that they were already basically analyzed with the algorithms that have not been altered since the 80s. So this is the only one where you can actually get the raw data, more or less, raw data from the ultrasound and the scalp electrode and attempt to analyze them in a new way. So here, of course, the point is, you know, we don't look for the magic bullet. I'm not saying that the RMSSD is the only way. This is just one of those that seem to work really well into the fetal sheep for some of the conditions, but we look for a kind of a tractal landscape of heart rate variability measures that would be able to describe the inflammatory response and the response to asphyxia in the best possible way. So just to remind you back at this other picture that I was able to find on Google, and that kind of gives that idea of the attractor landscape. And now this will not really take much time because the fetal AG is a story that is a bit easier to tell. These are the findings from about four actually years ago, where we saw that if we put an electrode to get the brain electrical activity from a fetus, from a sheep fetus, and we induce umbilical cord occlusions to induce severe acidemia, as you would see at the end of the labor approximately, then we seem to be able to detect the change in the spectral properties and the frequency properties of electrocortical activity that are associated in time with the decelerations of the theta heart rate that are always induced when you occlude the umbilical cord. If you had a chance to stand at the delivery ward and look at the baby to come out, this is what you would see in the sheep and in the human. So the theta heart rate decelerations are the physiological response to the occlusions of the umbilical cord. What we didn't know until then was that if you were able to get the brain electrical activity at the time, there is a change in the amplitude and in the frequency as shown here. And that may be used as a new tool to detect incipient acidemia well ahead of time, about an hour ahead of time as we saw. This is a set of experiments we did about 4 years after this one, a different set of animals, different set of umbilical cord occlusions as for the timing, and we again saw the phenomenon, which is an encouraging thing. It's always good to be able to corroborate your own data in another set of experiments. And what you see here is the tracing that simply signifies induction of umbilical cord occlusion when the curve goes up. And then here you see the electrocortical activity. So that's simply that's the recording of the electrical activity from the cortex itself. And then in the EEG, this is what we would be able to use in the fetus as a human fetus. So that's an electrode that would be applicable in a human fetus. So the amplitude is not as high, but you can still see the suppression of the amplitude when you have the occlusion. And we, of course, in the animal model, can also look at the blood pressure response and the heart rate decelerations that are occurring in the occlusion. And this is just zooming in. So when you have the occlusion, you will see a depression of amplitude. And we also see a change in the frequency. I just don't show it in this particular graph. But the summary of looking at the seven animals that we did last year was again that at the pH about an hour before the drop of pH under 7.00, which is considered a cutoff at which the risk for the cerebral palsy would increase so much that we want to be able to detect it well ahead of the time point. So we're able to detect that about an hour before the cutoff. And we see it by depression of amplitude, both in electrocortical activity and the EEG, and also changes in the spectral in the frequency domain. However, we do not see that at the moment in the fetal EEG, only in the ECOG. We're not too depressed by that because you have to consider that despite the similarities in the animal model, the brain of the fetal sheep is about the size of the fist. The brain of a baby is about maybe that size. So it's maybe 2 to 3 times as big. So the signal output will be a different one. So the signal-to-noise ratio will also be actually a whole lot better. So we expect to see the changes here if we go to the clinical stage and apply the electrodes in the setting of the labor in the human fetuses. So the multivariate, the idea to monitor the EEG and the fetal heart rate variability. I hope that by showing the data here, I was able to give you an idea why that could be really an approach above and beyond what we had so far, in a way that the combination of the recording, the brain electrical activity and the heart rate variability in the labor would allow us to characterize the physiology of the fetus in a much more encompassing way than just by looking at the fetal heart rate. And of course it's a challenge from a physiological standpoint, but I think we have assembled a lot of insight from the animal experiments in a decade or so now, and we have a fair bit of idea what we look at in the physiological responses. From a clinical standpoint, we have an electrode now that seems to work, that looks exactly like the electrode you use now to record the fetal heart rate on the scalp, but allows us to get the fetal EEG. So we're basically looking at now in the next year, actually years, to get approvals and to test it in the human fetuses. And from a mathematical standpoint, I'd like to leave you again with the epistemology. We always need to know how far we can go. I hope that what we would embark on would be dictated by this insight by a physicist, again, who said that the complexity on the surface seems to arise most of the time from a deep simplicity. An inspiring idea if you look to describe a pattern and you don't know where to start. And hopefully to find ways to devise the algorithms that would encompass the heart rate variability, the brain electrical activity, in a way that would allow us to map the changes of over time, so that we would just need to go from one hill to the next and say, okay, this is when I have inflammatory response, this is where I have asphyxia, and so on, in a simple way of speaking. So thank you from a person who works with sheep, and I think I kept the time not too badly.